This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Professor James Gates is a world-renowned theoretical physicist from Brown University. He's known for his work on supersymmetry and superstring theory, and for working to explain these and other physics topics to the average person. He recently visited the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse to give a physics seminar and public lecture, and he joins us now to talk about his work. So you're giving a public lecture during your visit here entitled A Life in Physics, Collaborations from Snoop Dogg to President Obama. And I think this is probably an unexpected title for a physics professor.
Yes. Well, first of all, Hope, thank you for the invitation to be here and to speak to you and your audience. Yes, the title sounds very strange because I live a rather strange life. Effectively, I have four careers and it takes me across various intersections. So this weird title is a reflection of my reality.
How has physics led you to these types of collaborations?
Sure. Well, this is a very interesting question and one that it would take a book to actually explain how I got from point A to point B. But it all starts when I'm 4 years old. I was living in St. John's, Newfoundland in Canada, and I went to see a movie. The movie was entitled Spaceways. And as a four-year-old, it caught my attention, and I came to understand that there's this thing out there called science that allowed you to have extraordinary adventures in life. And so that was my first sort of feeling and attraction. The family stories go, although I don't remember, that I tried to explain rockets to my father that evening. This military guy who had gone into the U.S. Army during the Second World War. So I'm sure that was amusing. I'm just sorry we didn't have smartphones that day. You could have made a quick video and gotten a few laughs, I'm sure. From that point on, it was science. It was the only thing I ever really wanted to do as an adult. There was various high points. When I was 8 years old, living in Fort Bliss near El Paso, Texas, my father brought some books home on space travel. And from those books, I came to understand that the lights in the night sky were not just like light bulbs, but they were actually places. But they were so small that because they were far away. So I experienced something like a miniature Big Bang between my ears and understanding how big the universe must be. So that added to my attractions for thinking about how to solve this mystery. I had a great group of teachers in high school. I went to Jones High School in Orlando, Florida. It was a segregated Southern high school in typical fashion. All of the students and most of the teachers were African Americans. But I had teachers that were just amazing. My physics teacher, for example, had an undergraduate degree in physics. That is extraordinarily rare to this very day. Most students don't have physics teachers who actually have a degree in physics, but my high school physics teacher did. His name was Mr. Coney. Miss Edna Williams was the first person who taught me the idea of rigorous logical thinking when I took my geometry class. And so they prepared me very well to go off to MIT, which had been a dream of mine since I was 14. I found out about this college, university, where, to my mind, they only made you study math and physics, and I called that the good stuff. So I wanted to go off to that place and study the good stuff. And then when I was 18, I was there. So it's kind of remarkable.
What have been the biggest barriers in your career, do you think?
It is sad to say that we in our country still have an amazing amount of discriminatory actions and activity that occur for people of color, and especially people of the African diaspora. And so my friend Neil deGrasse Tyson said it best. So let me repeat his words. He says, you pay the tax. There's an extra tax that one has to pay to try to be successful in these circumstances. But you pay the tax, and if you're in position to do so, you can accomplish some remarkable things that you didn't even know you had as dreams.
You served on President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and part of that work was looking at how to incorporate more science, technology, engineering, math, STEM into K-12 education. I think we hear a lot about encouraging more women to seek careers in STEM, but I wonder, what are the conversations like around encouraging people of color to seek careers in these fields?
Sure. Well, first of all, they're very similar. Let me say some words about this to make sure that the context of these conversations is broadly understood. Many people, when they hear discussions around STEM, they think that those that are having discussions are trying to push the idea that we need more professors, we need more professional engineers, we need more people performing at the highest levels in the disciplines. And it turns out that's not right. That's not why STEM is actually important for our society. There's no evidence that our society is underproducing such people, and at least no evidence I've ever seen. So there seems to be a sufficient number of engineers and scientists and professional practitioners of these disciplines to drive our economy. But what's lacking, and in fact, what is the crisis, is at a different level. So many of your audience members may know about self-driving cars, but fewer of them likely know that there are actually self-driving 18-wheelers that exist already. Because of that, you can now see that we're going to see a disruption likely, in another disruption in the economy. Namely, somewhere between 3 and 5 million people in the United States make their living in long-haul trucking. And now you have this technology, robotics and computers, where you can put instruments that are in control of 18-wheelers. They don't get tired. They don't need to be fed. They don't go on strikes. They can drive for long hours well beyond human capacity. And therefore, the efficiency of transport of goods and services by long-haul trucks, all of the efficiency arrows point towards using this technology. So this technology is going to require a different kind of mindset for people who are involved in long-haul trucking. And that's the reason why STEM is important. It's not about producing scientists and mathematicians. It's about the ways that our economy are evolving. And it turns out that you can show evidence that young people who are trained well in STEM at K through 12 level have a better chance of getting these jobs that are being created by the new technologies. That's what's going on. And that's what often seems to be lost in many discussions I see.
I think the field of education has been talking about STEM for many years now, but what more can we do to incorporate STEM in K-12 education?
I also served as a member of the Maryland State Board of Education for 8 years while I was advising the White House. So I'm a scientist, and so if you put me in such circumstances, I'm going to look at them as a scientist looks at any set of questions. And so there are a couple of things that I found from both of these experiences, as well as interacting with many people who are far more deeply experts in these matters than I. The first thing is that, at least in these areas, our country suffers from an appallingly low number of teachers who have deep mastery of these subjects. And as a consequence, what you find is often a course like chemistry or physics might be taught by a football coach. You find that teachers, in some sense, we don't support our teachers, which is to me remarkable. Teachers are treated as though they are interchangeable. So if you had a problem with your vision, you probably wouldn't go to a podiatrist, and you would think that someone who recommended that you go to a foot doctor was probably not a close friend. And yet that's what we sort of do to teachers. We think that a teacher trained in one discipline can just simply be moved to the other. There's not going to be any diminution of the expertise and their ability to convey the information. And so, first of all, we don't actually properly support our teachers. And this is even before you get to the issue of their financial remuneration. As you know, we've had a couple of strikes in the country recently, one in West Virginia and more recently almost a strike in Oklahoma. And the whole issue is teacher pay. And so the first thing is you have to say, we need to reward these people commensurate with the importance of what they're doing for our country's future. And so that's where it starts. The other thing is that once you actually get past that barrier, and that's an enormous barrier, that the federal government has very little possibilities of control. There are about 14,000 school districts in this country. The federal government has control of essentially none of those. If you look at funding for education across the United States, about 5% of that funding comes from the federal government. And so it's local control, which many of us champion and think are extraordinarily important aspects of our educational system, but that very local control means that we have not had the opportunity to have a conversation that drives for uniformity in terms of standards and practices that the country's economy needs. And so we've got to have a way to do that. Some progress perhaps was made in the previous administration. There was a program called There Was No Child Left Behind, but there also Race to the Top. And these two things acted to sort of mitigate against that, but now we seem to have, as a country, fallen back into our usual habits. And the most dangerous thing as a consequence of that is that when we look at the future, those of us who think about what the economy is going to be in the next 10, 15, or 20 years, when we look at that future, we see a threat to the standards of living that most Americans have had over the course of the last 50, 60 years. And there is another country out in the world that does not seem to be suffering from this kind of disconnect between the investment in education and understanding the return on investment that will come about in the economy. And this country is going to be our major competitor. Her name is China.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with world-renowned physicist James Gates, a professor at Brown University. He recently visited La Crosse to talk about his work in theoretical physics and the importance of STEM education. We've been talking about your work on a presidential council in the Obama administration, but you've also had maybe a more unexpected collaboration with Snoop Dogg, and I just wonder if you could talk about what that's about.
So let me just say that collaboration is too strong a word for my encounter with Snoop. And it wasn't actually an encounter in person. First of all, let me just make sure that your audience understands when you say work with President Obama, it was as a member of a council of 20 persons, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. This is a group that has existed almost continuously since the Second World War. It started under President Roosevelt. It stopped under President Richard Nixon, but then it was started by President H.W. Bush. And it had been continuous up to our current administration because the nation, this advisory group, actually works with the United States, the presidential science advisor. Our country currently has no presidential advisor, and therefore there's no one for this group to work with. And in fact, the group does not exist right now. And so this is the first time sort of in the modern history of the country that you do not have a group of entrepreneurs, scientists, and educators who directly interact with the office of the president to talk about policy that to be beneficial for the country's future. So that was my collaboration with President Obama. It's true that I was in meetings with the president somewhere in excess of 10, 15, or 20 hours. I've never kept track of the log, but some substantial time. So much so that I think I got some insights into his personality. Now, let me get to the Snoop part. So I effectively have four careers. I have been teaching in the classroom since the summer of 1972, so this is my 46th consecutive year teaching either mathematics or physics to college-level students. My next career started in 1975. I work on mathematical physics. Perhaps some of your viewers or you are familiar with a show called The Big Bang Theory. There's something called string theory. That's a real subject in our world, and real people do it. I'm one of them. And I'm not Sheldon Cooper, obviously. So that was my second career. My third career is one that sort of led to my interaction with Snoop, but not directly the person. So I've done over a dozen science documentaries, typically NOVA-type programs, Discovery Network types of documentaries, one on history. And the far end of my media career is actually commercials. I've done two commercials, one for Verizon and then one for TurboTax. But because of these pretty broad interactions with the public, I speak to the public fairly frequently, public lectures and what have you, in addition to the documentaries. But because of that, people out on the web, you know, the web is an amazing thing, the result of science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But people on the web are often looking for content. And so about 4 years ago, one day my twin son and daughter, both of whom have now graduated, my daughter has a double majored in math and physics, and my son majored in biology. So they both seem like they're headed to becoming scientists. But they came to me one day about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and said, "Dad, we heard you have a new video out." And I'm like, "I have no new video." They're like, "Oh, but all our friends are talking about it." I'm like, "I have no new video." And so finally, one of them gave me a link, and I clicked the link, and there, sure enough, there was a webpage at a site called World Star Hip Hop. And at the upper part of the webpage, there was a picture of Snoop Doggy Dogg. and talking about his one of his latest CD collections or what have you. And under that was a video running of me talking about my science. And so that's as close as my collaboration with Snoop came. I didn't take a screenshot that day. I should have, because to me this is amazing that I wound up on a webpage with Snoop.
I mean, what do you think that says about just bringing, you know, topics like theoretical physics that can feel inaccessible? And I just wonder, you know, what does this say about bringing these topics to the public and encouraging, you know, more conversation?
Sure. So first of all, it says a couple of things. It speaks, first of all, to the basic nature of being a physicist. I have on a number of occasions told people that being a theoretical physicist is almost exactly like being a novelist. Well, what do novelists actually do? Well, they use words, paragraphs, sentences, but they use these in the service of telling a story. It's a narrative that they're creating. And so what theoretical physicists do is we take mathematics, plus science equals science, weird derivatives, calculus, and pieces of mathematics that I could spend an hour naming for your audience. And we use all of these things in the service of telling a story. And the story is about nature and how to accurately describe what goes on in nature. When you do that properly, it's a little bit like going to Hogwarts. You know, what do they do in Hogwarts? Well, they teach the kids how to speak incantations, typically in something that sounds like Latin, and then a real effect occurs in the world around them. Well, that's what we scientists actually do. When we understand something in nature, we are then able to point the rules for how to create technology and apps for bringing about a change in our world. The most powerful example I know of this story goes back to 1860. Most people have never heard of a physicist named James Clerk Maxwell. But in the 1860s, he developed four equations which described everything that we have ever observed about electricity and magnets. And those equations led directly over 150 years to Wi-Fi and radio signals and broadcasts. That's the kind of power that resides in theoretical physics.
You're known for your work on supersymmetry and superstring theory. I wonder if you can, you know, kind of translate those, you know, theories and principles to kind of what questions, what impacts in nature, you know, we see.
Well, string theory is sort of a misnomer. First of all, the general public, when they use the word theory, they're really using it interchangeably with the word guess. So the first thing is, we don't do that typically. In science, when we say a theory, what we're talking about is a system of organizing beliefs that are consistent with an even larger body of observed facts. We call that an accepted theory. We have more speculative theories. That is, we have pieces of mathematics that are internally consistent mathematically and to an extraordinary degree, but have yet to be observed in nature. The Higgs boson is a story like that. 40 years ago, those equations were created, but it was only in 2012 that we actually saw the Higgs boson. So that's a different kind of theory. It's a theory that is waiting for the evidence. String theory is sort of like that, but even far worse. String theory is right now a set of collection of mathematical facts, incredibly intricate. And for those of us who are capable of studying the mathematics, most of us are extraordinarily convinced that there's something important for humanity's history in the future in these equations. Just like Maxwell gave us equations that led to Wi-Fi, we think these equations are going to lead to something incredible. Now, it may be a couple of centuries. That's the thing to understand. But many of us are convinced that that's the route. So string theory is an idea that basically says that if you want to understand everything, then the first thing you should think about are what I like to call little filaments, little things that are like violin strings, and what are their properties and how can they move, and what's the mathematics of their properties. And it turns out, in the context of string theory, we see enormous amounts of evidence that all the equations that describe our world can have that as a beginning.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Brown University Professor James Gates, a world-renowned physicist who recently visited La Crosse to talk about his work and the importance of STEM education. As you mentioned, you know, you've been a part of a number of documentaries, PBS, BBC. explaining these theories to the public. And, you know, I just wonder if you could talk about why it's important to have these conversations outside of university classrooms, outside of labs.
Sure. So first of all, not everyone has a chance to go to university. So if you're going to disseminate this information generally in the public, you cannot use universities and colleges as gateways for the conveyance of that knowledge. So in addition to things like science documentaries and public lectures, I have recently actually completed my first book for the public. It's called Reality in the Shadows, or What's the Hex the Higgs? And it's my attempt, together with a real rocket scientist, a retired rocket scientist named Frank Blitzer, and a real Higgs hunter, a guy named Steve Sakula, who's a professor in Texas. And the three of us collaborated on this book to try to explain to the general public how theoretical physics has evolved and how it actually works. So the first thing is you have to think of all possible venues for making this transmission of information. It can't be just through colleges and universities and lectures. You've got to think about media, multimedia, and of course we see the web and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and all of these things brought this service. Last year, I finally allowed myself to be engaged with social media, because for a long time I avoided that. But a third party organization actually runs a Facebook page and a Twitter account, and they're called, the names are Dr. Jim Gates or Dr. _ Jim Gates, and you can find me there. And I post things there in the attempt to open up what my life and what I experience as a scientist is actually like. So, for example, recently Stephen Hawking died, as many of your audience members will know. I had known Stephen from 1980 until recently. Last time I actually saw Stephen was in 2008. In 1998, I was with Stephen in the Clinton White House. So I've had a number of interactions. So on the day of the announcement of his death, BBC America asked me to come into the studios and record some recollections of my interactions with Stephen. And so I posted those to both my Twitter and Facebook accounts for anyone who wants to get a different view of how scientists actually live, as opposed to the cartoon that you see with Sheldon Cooper.
As you mentioned, you know, Stephen Hawking passed away earlier this year. What can we take away from his life and his career?
Yeah. So one of the things I commented about Stephen is I called him the bravest physicist I've ever met, because the challenges that he faced were just incredible, and yet he overcame them all with a dedication and a kind of retention of his humanity that is and was quite remarkable. In 2001, I had the opportunity to be Stephen's lunch mate for about an entire semester at Caltech, and I'm sorry, it was 2002. And so I got to know Stephen at a very different level through that 3 or 4 month period, which was quite kind of remarkable to me. And I had understood many things about his science long before then. For example, the work that made him most famous was about black holes and some of the properties that they acquire when you take into account this thing we call quantum mechanics. But in this 2002 period, I had a chance to sort of get to know him as a person. And one of the most remarkable discoveries of that period was, everyone knows that Stephen couldn't speak at that point and had electronic devices that he used to communicate. And I think he was still using his finger to tap out keys. Later, it would be motion of his either eyelids or some part of his face that he would use to interface with electronics. But even with that challenge, I found out Stephen liked to gossip. And if you think about that, that is just so amazing that here's this guy, one of the probably the world's best-known physicists, has made this amazing discovery about black holes, and he's this person, even though he's challenged like that. So to me, it was just an amazing opportunity to see a true genius. And his courage inspired me, quite frankly. When I was young, I used to I described what my desires were. I had a wish to find a magical piece of mathematics that was nevertheless an accurate description of something deeply hidden in nature. And my interactions with Stephen were such that, you know, I took encouragement that he could pursue his dreams, and well, why couldn't I? And so at this point in my life, I've created this really weird piece of mathematics. It goes by the name Adinkras, A-D-I-N-K-R-A, and it sits on the interface of mathematics and graphical imagery and computer science and information and codes. And that's, by the way, why I was on the webpage with Snoop Doggy Dogg, because the interview was actually about my research where we have found this strange connection between computer codes and equations of physics. That's why what the people who run the webpage found so amazing and had me with Snoop under that. But part of that, as I said, came because of observing Stephen's bravery.
Was there anything I didn't ask you about that you think would be important? What would be important for people to know?
So I'm the father of a set of twins. I've been married to my wife now for 33 years. She's a medical doctor, a pediatrician. But my twins amaze me. I have a boy-girl set of twins. And when we were raising them, we never even hinted that they should become scientists. But when they got to university, my son wound up getting a bachelor's degree in biology, and my daughter double majored in math and physics. And so it looks like I'm going to be the father of scientists. I've actually written research papers with my daughter when she was an undergraduate, so she's a published author. And right now I'm actually working on a research paper with my son, the biologist, which I never expected would happen. But it will be, for me, one of the greatest joys of my life if I have a chance to publish with both of my twins.
What do you think the biggest challenges your children will face as they pursue careers in the fields of science?
Well, part of it would be the same challenge, the issue of race in the United States. That's it may not be a permanent part of our society, but it's a problem that it will be several hundred years before I can imagine we will have made enormous progress. There always will be small progress. And those who say that there's no progress are not looking, in my opinion. No one like me could have existed 30 or 40 years ago. So there's progress being made. It's glacial, but it's progress. That's going to be the biggest problem my children will face, I'm confident. There are also going to be other large issues that not just my children, but all the young people of their generation are going to face. Our country looks to be in some sort of crisis. Those of us who read history have seen this pattern many, many times before. And one of the strange things is that if you look at democracies, they often run into trouble in this period when they're something over 200 years old, in the 200-300 year period. And if you look at our politics in our country today, it looks classically like all the examples that you can draw in history of where democracies fail. And so that's going to be an enormous challenge that my children's entire generation is going to be facing.
What would be the most important thing for them to remember as they take on this challenge?
I can only talk about the things that have served me well in my life and I think would serve anyone well. The first one is you actually have to be able to dream of something better and larger and bigger than what you see around you at any given time. It's important to work as hard as you can for both yourself and for other people. And especially the latter part of that is extraordinarily important. I guess the other thing that I would urge my twins and their entire generation is don't lose faith that you have the ability to solve whatever problems you confront, be it climate change, which, you know, those of us who are scientists, we're not in doubt about climate change. I mean, it's portrayed often in our society as if there's some scientific debate underway. There's not. There are people who have financial interest who wish to have that image out there. But in the scientific community, there are very few scientists have a debate about the issue of climate change. So for the younger generation, I would simply say that the thing that, to me, that is most magical about our country is it's a country where, in the past at least, we have been able to dream as a collective people and solve problems. And that's what I want the future generations to do.
Brown University professor James Gates is here with us today to talk about his work in theoretical physics and encouraging more conversations and education in the fields of STEM. He recently visited La Crosse to give a physics seminar and public lecture at UWL. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Last year, Hidden Figures, a movie about the black women who worked at NASA in the 1960s, sparked a national conversation about women's contributions to science. But almost 50 years before that story, female scientists like Henrietta Leavitt were already contributing to our understanding of the stars. Now the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro, Minnesota is highlighting Leavitt's story through a play called Silent Sky. Joining us now to talk about the production and the story behind it is Adrian Sweeney, External Relations Director for the Commonweal and Director of Silent Sky. Adrian, who was Henrietta Leavitt?
Henrietta Leavitt essentially was the person who mapped the stars for us, and she basically, her discoveries proved that there are galaxies outside of ours. At that point in time, we still were wrestling with the idea, is the Milky Way it? Is that all there is? And through her discoveries, she was able to lead us to the discovery that no, in fact, there were many billions upon billions of galaxies outside of ours. She's a very unassuming woman, very brilliant, very smart. She grew up in Massachusetts, and she really pioneered, she forged a path for herself as women were not readily available to, the sciences weren't readily available to women.
What was her role at Harvard? She wasn't necessarily recognized as an astronomer there.
That is correct. She did not actually have an astronomy degree. And the thing that was most compelling about not only Henrietta Leavitt, but Annie Cannon and Wilhelmina Fleming and the fellow, they call them computers, the fellow female computers, much like Hidden Figures. The thing that was so shocking is that they weren't able to access the telescope. The telescopes were off limit. So these women sat in attic rooms at Harvard in the observatory offices, and they studied plates. Images were taken from the telescopes and burnt onto plates, and then these plates, hundreds upon hundreds of plates, were given to these women, and they charted them. They documented the size of the stars, the luminosity of the stars, the proximity of the stars in relationship to each other, and then they filled logbook after logbook after logbook with this information. It's fascinating work. You can actually go online to the Harvard Observatory website and see there are people now who are working tirelessly to digitize these images because they're still on glass plates. So that's what these women did. Henrietta discovered a pattern in the Cepheid stars, the pulsing, which led her to discover that the brighter stars weren't always the closest, and it was that pulsing that led her to her next discoveries, which is known now as Leavitt's Law.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, her discovery at the time, I mean, did scientists recognize it for kind of what it was?
Yes and no. I think, yes, they did recognize that this was monumental, this discovery. But I think even back then, not just because she was a woman, but I think they didn't realize what it was revealing to us. I think it took a couple, 3 years of people digging into this discovery to really put together, piece together what this meant. And I don't think it was necessarily, from what I saw or from what I read in my research, it wasn't necessarily because she was a woman. It was because this was a jaw-dropping discovery, much like Einstein's discovery.
You mentioned Annie Cannon and Wilhelmina Fleming. They are also characters in this show and also women scientists at Harvard.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about them.
Oh, they're just delightful. The thing that's a little bit sad about Henrietta is that very little biographical information exists on her. So much of the play is actually fictionalized. It's gleaned from information that we know, but very little exists biographically about her. Much more exists biographically about Annie Jump Cannon and Wilhelmina Fleming. And in fact, pages upon pages of Wilhelmina Fleming's journals and entries exist, and they are delightful women, just so delightful. It's worth just kind of paging through Wilhelmina's journals just to get to know them a little bit better. And in fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson has an entire episode of his Cosmos series on the women of the Harvard Observatory. And the thing that I find so inspiring and that I love most about the play is how these women really supported each other. There was not very much competition that we're seeing in the journals and the entries left for us. They're very supportive of one another, and they encouraged each other, and their discoveries led to other discoveries from one another. They leapfrogged off of each other. But there was never really a sense of competition or backbiting or backstabbing. It was really a very collaborative kind of posse of female scientists that we see, of course, left over from history.
So Silent Sky, it's a play following mainly Henrietta Leavitt's life by Lauren Gunderson. Mm-hmm. Can you just kind of fill us in on the plot and the storyline?
Well, the plot is, Silent Sky is absolutely beautiful. It is a romance of sorts. It's a love letter to science. Lauren Gunderson is an incredibly bright woman, and she loves science herself. So a number of her plays actually are about different elements of science, different people in the scientific community. So it's very clear how much she loves science in this play. And it's also very clear what a strong female voice she is. Lauren Gunderson is the second most produced playwright in the United States after William Shakespeare. If you'll remember, I've been here on your show before talking about Ibsen. It used to be Ibsen. So a 30-something-year-old woman has dethroned Ibsen as the second most produced playwright in the U.S. And I think with good reason. She is just a very brilliant, creative voice in theater right now, and it's very exciting. So again, the play Silent Sky is fictionalized. I feel that Henrietta's story in the play is a bit of an amalgamation of other female scientists, again, because so little actually exists on Henrietta's life biographically. But it tells the story of a young woman who has difficult choices to make. She has to get her father's permission to go from the Midwest to Massachusetts to take this job. She has to ask for her dowry, which means she is basically telling herself in the world that she won't get married. She will be making a quarter an hour to do this work. As she puts it, it's volunteering. But it's because she has a love not just for this guy, but for science and discovery and study and research in general. So she ends up at the observatory where she works with Wilhelmina Fleming and Annie Jump Cannon. And again, they make these massive discoveries that have changed. The discoveries are legitimate, and they have changed the way we see space in the sky today. There is a love interest that factors in that we don't think is biographical, but it surely is delightful and provides a lot of fun and whimsy for the show as well. But at the end of the day, again, it's a real love letter to science. It's beautiful. And even if you don't get astronomy, even if you don't think that that's your bag, watching other people be passionate about their thing is so inspiring, and it's so creative.
You mentioned, this piece of information. She talks about, working, basically volunteering to do this work, not really being paid. And that is true that, she at first was basically volunteering and paid, and then later returned to Harvard in a paid position. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think that says about about the passion she must have felt for this field of science.
Well, it's incredibly obvious to me, having done the research, having spent so much time with Henrietta and the ladies, that they were so driven. They were so driven by what's out there, what the possibilities are out there. She just wasn't able to accept pat answers. And in the play, well, in real life, Henrietta dies very young. She contracts cancer. And so she dies very young. And one of the things she says, she just can't sit still. She can't not know. And then she catches herself and she says, well, I know I'm not going to ever know everything, but I have to keep knowing something. And so it's that drive for discovery, I think, is what is so inspiring.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about Henrietta Leavitt, an American astronomer who contributed greatly to the field of science before women were even allowed to vote. She's the focus of a new play at the Commonweal Theater, Silent Sky. We're here with the show's director, Adrian Sweeney. You know, we've talked about the playwright Lauren Gunderson. You know, she is has won several awards, is recognized in the theater community. And one thing I found interesting in kind of reviewing some of her biographical information specifically about this play is that when she was asked about the play's message, she said she felt like that message was that women aren't asking for special treatment, that we are showing how special we are. Always already are and always have been, and we're not asking anyone to let us participate. We are exclaiming that we have participated in discoveries, breakthroughs, and wild achievement all along. That's a quote from the playwright Lauren Gunderson. I mean, that's a very inspiring message, and I feel like it is very relevant to a lot of the conversations that are going on right now about, discrimination based on sex.
Oh, yes. Everything you just said. all capitals, yes. Wow, yeah. The fact is that we are in a place now, and I think for better, it's been a challenging time. It's been a challenging few years as we start to really unknot the place that women take in society. And in my work researching the show, in the actresses' work, working on the show, we have really spent some time focusing on women in science. But look, now we're in science. Like you said, like Lauren said, they've always been there. There was a great article in the Christian Science Monitor that someone sent me after they saw the show. Breaking barriers, it's part of the job for women. And it always has been. Women have always been involved in science, in medicine, in engineering, and all kind of fields, in creativity, in writing, and we're just now at the point where we're saying, we've always been here. We've always been doing these things. This is not new. This is not a fly-by-night thing that's happening. It's just a matter of, hey, yeah, we're here. Let's all just be part of the conversation. Let's all just open the doors. There's an amazing article that I saw in the New York Times about an African-American female scientist. There is a large photo. There has to be 30 scientists in this black and white photo shot in 71, I believe. All men, except for one person. Dead square in the middle, there's a woman, African-American. Half of her face is hidden as she's standing behind a male scientist. And a female researcher, contemporary, was doing research and became somewhat obsessed by this half-shrouded woman. And she set loose on social media to find the identity of this woman, who's the only person who is not identified in the photo. And she found the woman. She found this scientist, a 71-year-old marine biologist. I believe the woman lives in California. And the woman was so nonplussed. She said, oh, you know, this is, I didn't ever do this to become known. It's just the work that I did. And I think that's what's so interesting. We're not asking for special acknowledgement. We're not asking for special treatment. We're just asking for acknowledgement.
Do you think that, local, state, even nationally, we're doing enough to encourage the next Henrietta Leavitt?
We're getting there. We're getting there. You know, STEM programs are becoming so well known, so well respected, and young women, little girls are being encouraged to develop this part of their brain, this part of their interest base. And conversely, young men are hopefully being encouraged to explore all of their interests. I have a friend whose young son loves Shopkins, which I don't have children, but I understand that is a stereotypical little girl's toy. And he even says, I don't care, I get made fun of at school, but I think it's fun. So what I'm hoping that we're coming into is an age where kids, children, students are encouraged to follow their interests regardless of their gender and regardless of what that interest might be. STEM programs are out there. They're hopefully accessible to any student who wants to be a part of it. But I do believe that we have to, as the adults, we have to encourage our kids, especially our young women, to follow their passions, to follow their interests, especially if they're not normal, and I'm using air quotes, which of course people can't see, but anything that might be slightly off center. And I certainly wish that the sciences weren't considered such for women, but I think they are. And I think that we could always do a better job encouraging that. We're getting better. We just have to keep going, have to keep moving forward.
Why did the Commonweal want to do this play?
This is a relatively new play, and a friend handed it to me. He had seen it done in the Twin Cities. He said, you have to do this play. And I took it on the plane with me, and when the wheels touched down, I was texting the artistic director, who happens to also be my husband, and I was like, we are doing this play next year, no matter what. It is a play that even reading it gives me goosebumps. It is so visually stunning. It is a... it's just such an empowering play, just reading it. The language is beautiful. It could be read just as a short story. The language is so beautiful. But wow, it's not often you get to do a show with four women, all of whom are so super strong. The characters are so grounded, so real, so smart, so funny. And they play so well together. That's the other thing. I think it's really easy to fall into stereotypes where women are combative or competitive, and that is just in no way the case in this play. There's a fourth woman who is Henrietta's sister, and she is a musician, and she's a highly spiritual person. She teaches Sunday school. Their father was a pastor. And that's another thing that's beautiful about this play is the dualities that are inherent in this play. So the play talks a lot about not just science, but about the juxtapositions of science and faith, science and religion, art and science, music and math. And that is another thing that makes it beautiful. It's not science overall. It's where does everything fit in your particular personal universe?
This is a big year for the Commonweal Theater, right? You're celebrating an anniversary.
Yes, we are. We are celebrating our 30th season in Lanesboro. So April 7th, we opened our 30th season. We're very proud to do so with this show. And it's a great season ahead of us. We're very lucky to be able to produce professional live theater in a town of 700. There are 15 of us who live and work there year-round. We run the theater, and then we have apprentice company and seasonal company members.
Silent Sky is currently being performed at the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro until June 23rd. What do you hope audiences walk away thinking about?
I hope audiences walk away feeling inspired. In my director's notes in the program, I touched on the passions of all of these people. There's also one male character as well. And I am so energized by the passions of these people. Again, not just science, not just math, but music and art and spirituality and religion. So if I could pick one thing, I hope the show would get people thinking about what are their passions, what inspires them, what gets them out of bed in the morning, what drives them. It might not be your 9-to-5 day job. It might be something you do on the weekends. It might be your extracurricular activity, as it were. But I just hope that people walk away rejuvenated and encouraged to reconnect with their personal passion.
We've been talking with External Relations Director for the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro and director of the company's current production, Silent Sky, Adrian Sweeney. The show tells the story of Henrietta Leavitt, an American astronomer who contributed greatly to our understanding of the stars before women were welcomed into the field of science. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview with world-renowned physicist James Gates, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. There you'll also find links to more information on the Commonweal's production. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.